This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I think there's another solution. You do year-round schooling and you schedule it so there's just no school the entire month of December.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a woman who just won a $10,000 bet with Mitt Romney, Daniela Fairchild.
Hands are in the air, raised in excitement right now, $10,000.
So that was fun this week. You know, this is these candidates, they just can't help it but be themselves. And Mitt Romney, he's a rich guy, right? He can't help it. We should know that. And we should be, you know, in my view, look, I don't know if we're ever going to hire a president again who's not already rich. I mean, when was the last time that we had somebody who was not rich as president? You have to go way back. I don't know, Richard Nixon, maybe? Maybe Gerald Ford. Mm. It just seems like these days, it's hard to hire people who aren't rich for this job.
You can't fault them for what they are, you know?
Yeah. Now, Barack Obama was, you know, really paved the ground here in terms of becoming rich in part by running for president. I mean, it was the book. I mean, I think, you know, his rise and the book, and then it sold and became a bestseller, and he made a lot of money off that. People still think that's the case with Newt Gingrich, that he's still more than anything out there to sell books. But hey, he's at the top of the polls. Who knows? You think you might try this strategy at some point, Daniela?
The book selling strategy?
Yeah. I mean, how could you, run for office to try to sell books or do something outlandish to try to sell books?
Oh, I don't think Newt Gingrich would ever do anything outlandish, Mike, especially not to sell books, sort of, get them in the front pages.
Yeah. Anyway, we got a lot to cover today on the show. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We've got Amber's Research Minute and then Chris's What's Up With That? Now we've got intern Laura with Pardon the Gadfly.
Thanks, Mike. So first question. Today, Fordham released a paper by Mark Schneider, which asks, has the accountability era run its course? Well, has it?
Well, what he does, he looks at the NAEP scores over the last 20 years, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Mark used to oversee that program when he was the commissioner for the National Center on Education Statistics. We used to call him Stat Stud back then, and I will call him that again today. He is a stat stud. And what he shows is that leading states like Texas, who first embraced consequential accountability back in the 90s, testing and accountability, saw a one-time big spike in their math scores, and then over time it eventually plateaued. It has not fallen back down to where it was before, but it has not continued to advance. You now seem to see the same pattern happening nationally, and the argument is perhaps the rise of consequential accountability did have this big impact, but it does not lead to continued improvement over time.
So I guess the question there is, the Texas results, they spiked when in early 90s, I'm assuming, or shortly thereafter.
Not so much a spike. I mean, they went up dramatically and then they stayed up.
Sorry.
Right.
And then they've plateaued since then. I mean, that's including, you know, that's given the last few years of increased immigrant migration into Texas and an increased Hispanic population who presumably comes with more ELLs and things like that. So, I mean, if you're at minimum hitting a baseline there, if the accountability is creating at least that you know, safety net, so to speak, then, yep. I mean, that's a positive.
No, that's right. And he is able to look at this at different achievement levels to tease a little bit of this out. So it's not just looking at averages. And it's true. Demographics in states and certainly nationally have changed quite a bit over the last 20 years. But still, it seems to be pretty compelling evidence that the accountability impact is fading out. Now, you could argue this in lots of different ways. One is that policymakers have been less focused on accountability lately. You know, the No Child Left Behind has become a bit of a joke. Nobody pays attention to the AYP ratings anymore because they've lost credibility. States haven't been pushing the accelerator on that themselves, again, in part because of No Child Left Behind. So you could say, look, a renewed focus on accountability done right, maybe you could get another bounce. But look, I think that what we see on the horizon are some other reforms that are more likely to take us to the next level. Teacher accountability. You know, it was always kind of vague. What does it mean to hold a school accountable? Unless you close the school, which we've been unwilling to do in most cases, then what? But saying that we're going to fire teachers if they don't improve test scores, that's much more direct. And there's a real effort to make that more feasible with teacher evaluations and the like. And then the Common Core. You know, if some states do a good job implementing the Common Core and actually raise the bar in terms of instruction, that should show up in some improved achievement.
So I have this theory that it's maybe not just that it's the accountability. It was accountability as, you know, for accountability's sake that caused the bump in student achievement, and then, you know, maybe this teacher accountability or teacher evaluations and Common Core and things, but just that it's something new. It's, you know, a, you know, it's a kickstart to the system. And so any, you know, brand new big initiative, you'll see. And, you know, maybe we just need every 6 or 7 years, we just need another kick in the pants,
right,
and whatever that kick in the pants might be.
Right. And hopefully that's a kick in the pants and not spinning wheels.
Right.
Okay. Topic number two.
All right. The New York Times released another magnum opus on virtual education this week, this time targeting the for-profit K-12 Inc. Is the Times right to be so anti-digital learning?
I can't believe the lines have been drawn in this debate. We have, I mean, I can, we can make fun of the Times and say, you know, they live in an antiquated world of newspapers and 20th century print media, and therefore are clinging to their 20th century classrooms as a common, you know, common comrade, I guess.
Except we all read this article online.
Yeah, but I'm okay, fine. Touche, sir. Touche. But I'm so surprised at the line, like at the distinct line that they're taking, and then the visceral reaction that digital learning proponents have had to it. I mean, you get the standard Van der Ark, and but even some of our own Fordhamites have come in and said, you know, this is such a hatchet job on the, you know, by the Times. And we're just not, I mean, there aren't a lot of people out there. I think some are starting to step into the middle ground, into this no man's land, and really have a smart conversation about, yes, there are some problems with the way that K-12 is handling their.
Right. So, I mean, so what the article raises, it, first of all, it paints K-12 as a company that is trying to squeeze profits out of its operations. It's been, you know, getting public money to run these schools. It's raising class sizes to huge levels. It's cutting on quality. It's cutting corners also that the CEO can make $5 million a year. You know, and look, I mean, as a piece of investigative journalism, a lot of people outside of this world are going to read it and say, wow, that sounds pretty bad. And there are some easy targets to hit. I mean, it's certainly what struck me most was the incentives in place for a company like K-12 to sign up as many kids as possible in these schools, and that it's all about enrollment, and that we haven't in policy made any incentives for K-12 to get good results in terms of outcomes. I mean, unless they are, these schools are doing so bad that the plug is going to get pulled and there these charter schools are going to get shut down, then they, you know, mostly have an incentive to make them as big as possible and bring in as many kids and as many dollars. I do think you can move to some kind of form of performance-based pay, where K-12 only gets paid the full amount if the kid makes a year was worth the growth over the course of the year. And that could fix some of these quality concerns. That's the kind of conversation we need to be having. You know, but look, the Times is never going to like the idea of people making money off of public education, regardless of the fact that people have been doing it for decades, textbook companies and bus companies and others. But, you know, the idea of somebody making $5 million a year for running a company that runs schools, that is a fat, juicy target for the Times, and they hit it pretty good. One piece of disclaimer, of course, I did work at K12.com. I was the 10th employee hired, and I was then probably one of the first employees to go. So there we go. All right, topic number 30.
All right. More and more states are experimenting with state-run turnaround districts like New Orleans Recovery School District. Are these state-run initiatives the right way to intervene in failing districts?
You know, this is, I think, has a lot of promise. Right now, we see this in New Orleans, well, actually Louisiana as a whole, in Tennessee and in Michigan. Tennessee and Michigan are just getting started. What we've seen in Louisiana, though, is quite promising. You know, this got in place before the hurricane, but then became integral afterwards. It's, in a way, a form of state takeover. But instead of the state taking over the whole district, it just takes over the schools in the district that aren't succeeding and then can run them under new rules, maybe different union contracts, more flexibility, more autonomy. I think this has a lot of potential. It's a way, Daniela, to, you know, have the states intervene without saying to a local school board, you're fired. They keep, you know, they say in Detroit or in Nashville or Memphis, you know, they keep the schools that are working okay. They keep their central office infrastructure. They keep the school board, but you pull away the schools that most need help and have them operate under new conditions. I certainly think there's promise here.
So, I mean, I understand the, you know, porridge just right element of this, that, you know, you're not just ripping control away from the local school boards and, you know, coming in with this heavy hand from the state. But at the same time, I don't know if I understand the problem with doing that. If we, you know, if Detroit, which has been chronically low performing. And granted, you know, has seen some gains in math in the recent NAEP tutor results. So, you know, kudos to them for pretty big gains there, especially at the fourth grade level, but still is super, you know, super underperforming. And I don't know if it's a problem to have the state come in and especially restructure the central office, something that is known to be really bloated, especially in places like Detroit. And maybe if, you know, the state, if a group like that, that has some administrative experience, you know, maybe that's what they do best. Isn't necessarily to come in and, you know, direct individual schools, but...
Well, look, the history on state takeovers, and the New York Times wrote about this as we do, you know, has not been super promising. And usually what a state takeover means is that the state comes in and appoints a superintendent that reports to the state commissioner, and that's that. And nothing else necessarily changes. That person maybe has more of a free hand because they're not reporting to a politically controlled school board. They can be tougher on the unions and the other bargaining units. They can take tougher action. But, you know, that only lasts so long, and, you know, you just can't shield it from political forces forever. And in a lot of these places, I don't think they even succeeded in changing the contracts or the other rules on the ground. So in some ways, this state recovery district, this is much more radical because you're trying to uproot these schools from the failing system. I mean, the idea is that the schools are failing because the district is failing. And since nobody really knows how to turn around a whole failing district, at least we can take these schools out of the dysfunction and see if they can have a better shot.
And that's a good tie into the Michael Mintrim and Richard Wally piece in our recent governance paper series, which is online on our website, that it may or may not actually be the governance structure, but that, you know, it's the individual school model that really might make a difference. So if you do that, if we just allow, you know, we strip collective bargaining, we free up the hands of some of the school leaders to be able to do some good stuff, then maybe that's, you know, that's where these initiatives will take root.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
The waning days of 2011.
Coming down to the crunch. I'm going to New York City, by the way, did I tell you that?
Yeah, very that's exciting. You had this trip planned a year ago.
Yep, and we're trying again with no snow, hopefully. That we got snowed out last time, so.
Yeah, excellent.
Anyway, excited. Going to see some shows, Rockefeller Center, Ice Skate, all that stuff.
Nice. You going to go visit the Donald?
No, that wasn't on the itinerary.
Okay.
Sorry.
Just wondering. All right, what you got for us this week?
New report out from Change the Equation, which apparently is an advocacy outfit that focuses on STEM issues. Never heard of them.
Never heard of them. Okay. They're newish, I think.
Okay, well, the good thing is they partner with AIR, so they had some good sense. They basically say science proficiency standards across the states are ridiculously low. NCS, we know, has been publishing these NAEP scale equivalents for a while in math and reading, but nobody's really done it in science, so this was, you know, filled a little void. Plug for Fordham, real quick. We did the proficiency illusion, used NWE data in 2007, so we're familiar with these types of reports. I'd say that report was groundbreaking, but anyway, I digress. Analysts here use a similar procedure. They map the state's passing score on the 2009 eighth grade science test against the 2009 eighth grade NAEP science scale. Analysts had data for 37 states, found that 15 of them set the bar for proficiency below NAEP's threshold for basic. Four states set the bar near or above NAEP's cutoff for proficient. The states with the lowest cut scores are Virginia, Tennessee, and Michigan. States in the ballpark for NAEP proficient include one that we know. What is it?
Massachusetts.
Virginia. I mean, sorry, I'm on the wrong one. Louisiana. That's kind of surprising, don't you think? Rhode Island. Little bit surprising. In New Hampshire, those were our free high achievers. Just so you can see how these discrepancies play out, in Louisiana, with the high bar, 23% of eighth graders were proficient on the state test. Virginia, with the dubious honor of having the lowest below basic bar on the equivalency scale, 91% of their students are at or above proficient on their state test. And Massachusetts, which sets its bar near NAEP's, as 41% of students are scoring at or above proficiency, which sounds pretty good. Considering. So anyway, welcome light on science standards. And by the way, second plug in 1 minute. This is going to be a great precursor to Fordham's science report in January.
Very nice. That's right. We're going to be looking at the content of the science standards. And this is interesting. You're right. Louisiana is an interesting one. I mean, they've done a good job with their standards in some subjects. What's interesting on science is that they have a law in the books now that basically says that teachers are either required or expected or allowed to basically say that evolution is just a theory and, you know.
The 2008 Science Education Act, and they are allowed to basically say whatever's in the standards, and teach whatever you want. So teach creationism, teach, you know, intelligent design.
Right. You cannot all kinds of questions about global warming.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if parents complain, you can, you know, point them to the statute and they have no right to complain.
Yeah.
News to me.
But at least they have high cut scores.
They do.
Excellent. All right. So, and this is a similar story that we've told in math and in reading, and it's good that they did this in science as well.
Yeah.
The big question for the Common Core and for the new science standards that are underway by ACHIEVE, the national standards, is will they, at the national level, set the cut scores higher? They've all talked about setting a common cut score. There's going to be a lot of pressure to keep that modest. If we set it high, we're going to suddenly see lots of schools failing, and including, by the way, some famous charter schools that say they're closing the achievement gap.
Indeed.
And it will show that they probably are not closing the achievement gap if you're talking about a much higher proficiency bar.
Yeah, and I think you've said before on this show that NAEP's proficient bar is probably pretty high, you know, given all these different studies that keep coming out.
No, it is. And they've done some work to try to figure out what is college readiness, where is that at? And then, you know, they say it's somewhere between basic and proficient on the 12th grade NAEP, you know, that you hit proficient on the NAEP and, you know, you're for sure college ready. You're almost guaranteed to do well in college and graduate from college. That's a great bar, but, you know, the true line for college readiness might be a little bit lower.
Yeah. And this study did, by the way, I just didn't have time to talk about, they did look at ACT and try to draw some parallels on how many kids were college ready by state compared to the proficiency scores. And so Tennessee, for instance, 77% were proficient and then only 20% were college ready according to ACT. So that was another good little, you know, addition they put in the study.
Nice. Yep. All right. So what song goes along with this?
So we're going to beat up on Virginia for being, you know, having the dubious honor of the lowest cut score. So we've got Meet Virginia by Train.
She doesn't own a dress. Her hair is always a mess. If you catch her stealing, she won't confess. She's beautiful. Smokes a pack a day. You can wait, that's me. But anyway, she doesn't care a thing about that. Hey, she thinks I'm beautiful. Meet Virginia. She never compromises, loves babies and surprises, wears high heels when she exercises. Ain't that beautiful? Meet Virginia.
That song, Danielle. You're a big Train fan, I understand.
I am. I missed their concert last summer. They had a one down in the park in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I cry about it every night, actually, still.
You missed the train. It's now time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that?
Chris, welcome back to the show.
How's it going, Mike?
You know, I have to admit, it's been a little choppy today, but our listeners won't even know that because of the magic that our editor, producer, Joe Portnoy, puts into the show. He just cuts all that choppy stuff out.
He certainly is a magician.
He is that, indeed. He's juggling right now as we speak.
And he's pulling rabbits out of hats.
It's pretty amazing. The unicycle is pretty cool.
The monkey, though, where did that come from?
Yeah. Well, we'll put him back in the cage later. Don't tell the PETA people. Okay, Chris, what do you have for us? And towards the end of the year here, is there craziness during this holiday season?
Well, Mike, 'tis the season to be jolly. But apparently that's not the case in Canada, where bus drivers Diane Pope and Bridget Kleppe were ordered to remove the festive Christmas decorations from the interior of their school buses. Kleppe, who has been a bus driver for 15 years, said the children on her route love the decorations. Quote, "These kids can't wait to get on the bus and see what I've done, or to see what hat I'm wearing today," Kleppe said. The decorations on the inside of Kleppe's bus were difficult to see from the outside, so not to be distracting to other drivers. The ribbons, bows, snowflakes, and Christmas crackers were fixed to the ceiling. Stifling the holiday spirit for children? What's up with that? Of course, when contacted, the district played the ever-so-predictable religion card. And here I thought Canadians didn't put up with the same PC garbage we're busy drowning in here in the United States. I'm sick and tired of the trite excuse of religion as an excuse for quelling the holiday spirit. It's not as if these old women were proselytizing to students as they drove them to school. The decorations were non-denominational and simply added some fun and joy to a typically glum ride to or from school. If anything, the decorations during the lead-up to Christmas break gives bus drivers a chance to connect with students and a chance to show students their festive side. My Christmas wish is for people in power to stop playing Big Brother and let students celebrate and enjoy the holiday season.
Oh, wow. Impassioned. I like that. Yeah, I don't know what the legal culture is like up in Canada. You always think of Canada as just doing things in a more thoughtful way.
Yeah, they're just chill, laid back, you know, not all uptight about everything.
Now, of course, it does depend. I think it depends. I mean, are we talking about they've got, you know, the Jesus scene up there in the you know, or is it a Christmas tree and happy holidays? I mean,
from what the bus drivers reported, and of course, this is just me reading what they reported, they said it was completely non-denominational, just, you know, Christmas trees, presents, bows, gifts, things like that. I mean,
then this is outrageous.
I'm gonna go grab my pitchfork. We're gonna go rally. I'm curious as to what Christmas cookies are, though.
No, crackers.
Christmas crackers. What are those?
Maybe that's what they, you know, they're a little more health conscious up in Canada. Right. They go for the crackers instead of the cookies.
That's impressive. That's really impressive. Look, this is one of these areas where I just feel really bad for our public school officials, I guess in Canada too, because nobody has any clear idea about what's allowed. You know, the Supreme Court's totally divided on this. The case law, I mean, there's a crazy amount of case law on these questions, right? Can you have, you know, the manger scene or not, on where and when and how? And if you're a school official, I'm sure you just want the whole holiday season to be over with so you don't get sued.
I think they should maybe just start celebrating Christ Kwanzaa Dawn. You know, just everything all at once. If she puts a menorah, a Christmas tree, a African flag, I don't know.
That is the logical.
Then you're offending the atheist students. And
then we'll put a black hole.
Where does it stop?
Yeah. I think there's another solution. You do year-round schooling and you schedule it so there's just no school the entire month of December. All right. Well, thank you, Chris, for bringing us. You got one more of the year. Make it a good one. The last one of 2011. Excellent. I can't wait.
Yeah, Big Brother's not holding me back.
Yes. Okay, till next time.
I'm Daniela Fairchild.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off and wishing you happy holidays.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.